What happens when you flee a country to escape its crushing weight, only to discover you've carried it with you across an ocean? In 1961, James Baldwin's Nobody Knows My Name landed on American bookshelves like a confession nobody wanted to hear, but everyone needed. The collection spent months on bestseller lists, not because it offered comfort, but because it named something unnameable. The way America builds prisons out of identity itself, locking everyone inside cells marked by race, gender, and the desperate need to belong somewhere, anywhere.
Baldwin didn't find himself in Paris. He found America. In Swiss mountain villages, with Bessie Smith's blues crackling from his record player, he reconstructed the Harlem childhood he'd spent years escaping. Only by leaving could he see what he'd left behind. European cafe owners called him American before Black, a reversal revealing something profound. We're all exiles in our own country, Baldwin realized, Americans of every shade wandering through a nation that refuses to let anyone simply exist. European writers described societies with fixed coordinates, centuries-old class structures providing stable ground. American writers face quicksand. Nothing stays put. Everyone fighting constantly to define themselves against shifting myths. Europe gave Baldwin breathing room, space to stop apologizing, stop pretending to be a regular guy to satisfy America's suspicion of intellectual life. In Paris's left bank circles, writers belonged to an honorable tradition. Europe let him feel his own weight and value, see the sky as though for the first time.
At the 1956 Conference of Negro African Writers and Artists in Paris, Baldwin witnessed identity's complexity. African delegates described feeling and perception as unified experiences, unlike compartmentalized Western thought. Their art served communal functions. Masks embodied spiritual forces, facilitated ceremonies, bound communities together. Despite geographical separation, Black attendees shared a painful relationship to the white world and the aspiration to come into the world as men. Yet, unity was complicated. Can oppression constitute culture? Does shared suffering create legitimate bonds? Baldwin's light skin made him conspicuously pale among Africans who possessed a pride he both envied and found foreign. He feared they might despise his Western mannerisms and mixed heritage. This revealed the peculiar psychology of displaced peoples. American Negroes abroad circled each other at white gatherings, determining if the other was for real or kissing ass. Black identity exists not as a unified concept, but as a complex web of experiences and struggles, evolving through dialogue between communities, contributing unique perspectives to an ongoing conversation about race, culture, and belonging. Walking through Harlem, where his childhood home once stood, now replaced by a stark housing project, Baldwin documented how poverty functions as a self-perpetuating trap. Everything costs more when you're poor. Inflated rent for substandard housing, exorbitant insurance in high-risk neighborhoods, higher prices for inferior goods at local stores exploiting residents' limited mobility. Those few who escaped only reached what Baldwin called more respectable ghettos, which quickly deteriorated following the same pattern of disinvestment. Countless residents had surrendered to despair, spending days watching television behind drawn curtains or sitting stoned on stoops. Those maintaining jobs downtown endured daily microaggressions while fighting endless battles with negligent landlords, a constant strain driving even the strongest spirits toward exhaustion. The housing projects themselves became symbols of institutional racism, despised almost as intensely as police. These towering, prison-like structures suggested containment rather than community. Management exercised invasive control through regular inspections and arbitrary rules, reinforcing the message that residents couldn't be trusted. Meanwhile, police patrolled streets like occupying soldiers, and every resident carried stories of harassment or brutality. As Baldwin's plane descended over Georgia's rust-red earth, he imagined the soil colored by blood dripping from trees, horrors his father must have witnessed. He remembered Scottsboro, Angelo Herndon, Emmett Till. Now the South convulsed over whether Black children deserved equal education. He met G, a 15-year-old who had integrated a previously all-white high school. Despite his impassive face, his large dark eyes registered volumes. After his first day, his mother received calls warning her son would be cut to ribbons. White students blocked his entrance until the principal escorted him inside while others shouted, "Nigger lover." G spent his days in complete isolation. Even boys who initially befriended him withdrew after being called names. William Faulkner's stance on desegregation revealed deep contradictions. His repeated advice to go slow was fundamentally meaningless. As Justice Thurgood Marshall noted, they mean don't go at all. Most troubling was how Faulkner, while intellectually conceding racism's moral wrongness, simultaneously elevated it to a mystique beyond normal criticism or remedy. Baldwin's exploration of masculinity revealed how rigid gender norms create psychological prisons. His encounter with André Gide's final work marked a profound shift in understanding. Gide's seeming egocentricity wasn't vanity, but a fundamental condition of his existence and source of his deepest suffering. Society resists accepting homosexuality as natural because such acceptance would threaten the majority's carefully constructed sense of normalcy. Gide had invested his wife, Madeline, with an impossible role. She became the keeper of his moral purity, an abstract ideal whose purpose was to absolve him of his perceived hell. This arrangement allowed Gide to redirect guilt about his sexual orientation into guilt about failing Madeline, a more manageable form of suffering. Modern society has replaced authentic intimacy with superficial substitutes, artificial Hollywood glamour, and performative machismo. The resulting isolation of men from women creates a dangerous cascade. Men who cannot form genuine connections with women often lose their ability to trust other men, leading to profound social isolation that can breed violence. Baldwin's relationship with Norman Mailer illuminated another facet of American masculinity. To be an African-American male, Baldwin noted, is to be reduced to a walking phallic symbol, forced to bear the weight of other sexual anxieties. The crucial difference was that Mailer still believed he had something to preserve, his innocence, while Baldwin had never been afforded such luxury. America clings to myths divorced from reality. When self-image collides with truth, we must face it honestly or retreat into fantasy. This country will be transformed, not by divine intervention, but by all of us together. America's majority is defined by influence. What is honored in a country is cultivated there. European immigration waves seeking new identities swept away universal standards. Status became a substitute for identity, with money its symbol. The American self-image, hard work, clean fun, success, hides despairs we must confront. The Negro's treatment stems from our social panic about losing status. He marks where the bottom is. Our fear has nothing to do with actual Black people, but with something in ourselves we refuse to face. The American Negro knows Americans better than anyone because he's had to watch, outwit, and sometimes bleed with them since we arrived. This is a wedding. We are bound together forever. The artificial walls protecting us from what we fear must come down. We must create a country without minorities, where Americans achieve an identity not inherited but forged. All of us, together, finally willing to see ourselves clearly.